Dearly beloved, we're gathered here today to witness the union of two lives, that of James and Sarah. James, do you take Sarah to be your wife, to live together in the covenant of marriage? Do you promise to love her, comfort her, honor her, keep her in sickness and in health, and forsaking all others to be faithful to her as long as you both shall live?
I do.
And Sarah, do you now take...
I have written my own vows.
By all means.
James, I love you. I cherish every moment that we spend together. You're my hero and my friend. I promise that I will love you, honor you, care for you, and support you for the rest of my life. There's only one thing I ask in return. One day a year, only one day, I want to be single again. I want to be able to spend time with old boyfriends. With guy hunting, clubbing, that sort of thing. Whatever comes up for the day. Well, what do you think?
Well, James, it sounds reasonable to me.
Are you kidding? You must all be out of your minds.
What's the problem? What more could you possibly want from me?
Yeah, James, what exactly do you want?
What do I want? Well, I don't want you in a part-time. I want all of you. All of you should belong to me. Well, that's how this thing works.
Okay, for those of you who are offended at what might have been a patriarchal remark towards the end of that, just edit that out, you know, backspace, delete. That's not the point of it. But we are working from different cultural assumptions. And even within the church, we're working from different cultural assumptions. And the common ground that we could once assume, to some extent, or the common sense of values is not so much a given. And so one of the tasks of this generation again, and maybe every generation, is we know that there are truths that are immutable truths, and I think the Trinity is there. There are people who disagree. I don't think you can mess with the Trinity. It's the zip code of Christian faith. You can unpack almost everything from there. There are other values that are true, but they seem to be truer in some ages than in other ages, and in some ages they have no importance. For instance, in the 19th century, when evangelical revivals were underway, there was a problem with the working class who would drink their entire salary before they got home and children were starving. So if you became a follower of Jesus, you quit drinking, and that was a sign that you had changed your life. Obviously, the Anglicans didn't hit that part of the revival. Did you? I used to serve a congregation at West where the congregation, the NDP, were all temperance, and they sat on this side, and the conservatives were emphatically not, and they sat on this side of the church. And I met both liberals in Saskatchewan. They were very nice people. But what would happen is if I, as the minister of Fillmore, Saskatchewan, went to the cabaret, which was a sort of Friday night dance, my congregation would hide their drinks under their chair as soon as they saw me coming, which was really dull because it meant that I couldn't do anything either. And if we went to Doug's church, which was down the road in Creelman, Saskatchewan, 12 kilometers away, you could see my elevators from our kitchen. They would all buy us drinks, so we went to the dances at his church. But it's cultural baggage again. And so, like the Judaizers in the book of Acts, we are in the tough situation of figuring out what is really gospel and what is our baggage. And I don't know that we can ever know in our own generation what is our baggage. I suspect that for the generation of people who now are in their 20s and 30s, our legalistic, our baggage, behavior baggage that is going to become more important than any other, the thing that is holding people back, breaking up homes, and holding back expressions of church is probably the debt load they're carrying. I suspect that if we want to disciple people in their 20s and 30s, one of our big issues is going to become addressing the issues of consumer debt and credit card debt, because if you have $19,000 on your credit card plus more on your line of credit, then it doesn't matter what you learn about Jesus, you can't do anything. You are enslaved to the past of your spending. And I suspect that our big teaching for that generation is going to be teaching people that if you are a follower of Jesus, you will live at 80% of your income. Because right now, people, no matter what their income level is, are living at about 110, 120% of their income. And people can't tithe. They can't even think about tithing. They can't barely make the minimum payment on their credit card. They're going bankrupt once, twice, three times before they're even 30 years old. Can you imagine? And so we, as followers of Jesus, I suspect that that is going to be our practical expression of lifestyle evangelism in this generation. I hope it does not become an issue of legalism, but I cannot see how people can become followers of Jesus when they have $20,000 on their line of credit and half their every paycheck goes to making their minimum interest payments. And if you're carrying credit card debt, with every head bowed and every, no. Bring them up. We'll cut them up. But it is really an obstacle to persons coming to faith in Jesus in ways that alcohol may have been in another generation. And that's why I think we need to choose our issues carefully and think through it. I'm going to invite you to put your heads together for a couple of minutes in twos and threes and share the phenomena that you have observed in your ministry setting that do not look like church as usual. Something that has perplexed you recently, and you said, "What in the world is that?" If you have all of the answers, do come up here and talk to me, because I've got all of the questions. Do you mind doing that? I know you introverts are going, but just this once. Just this once. Do it for George. Hey, Duke. And you may never know. So can you, if you can distill it to perhaps a sentence or so, can we have some shout-outs of the peculiar things that you're observing on your roads? Rent a priest, yeah. What else?
Commitment and belonging look different and are expressed differently than they were back in the 60s.
Yeah. Commitment, and they really do look different. And sometimes you say, is there any?
Groups of people will create, I don't know how to say this, create community and religiosity of their own without any reference to the church or the gospel or God or Christ or anything. I've seen this happen online with people who haven't even met face to face on different continents, who had what I can only describe as a funeral for a member who died.
Huh.
It was bizarre. No reference to religiosity.
The Greek mystery religions are alive and well.
I think so. But people, they had a need.
Yep.
They did it.
Yep.
We weren't involved because we had no entry point, no way to speak to
them. Okay, thank you. Yes.
As a tag on the changing face of what commitment looks like, there seems to be people who look at the process of rituals of commitment that are from generations ago for the sake of their grandparents.
Yes. Sure, yes.
Somebody wouldn't go to a funeral because they're too sad.
Yeah. More and more often. Or don't have, you know, funeral directors are saying they have a huge problem with people not picking up the ashes.
It's too sad.
Too sad to deal with. Yeah. Yeah.
I had a phone call from someone whose son was having his bar mitzvah. She was Anglican. The father was Jewish. The grandfather, who was a staunch Anglican, was refusing to go to the bar mitzvah because he couldn't quite figure this out. He couldn't put it together.
Yeah.
And it's raising all sorts of questions for Christians that we haven't wrestled with our theology
Okay, how do Christians relate to persons of other faith? We haven't had to do that for quite a few centuries.
And the intermingling of faith traditions.
Yes. Patrick, and then...
And related to that, the rise of generic spirituality that has no particular expression.
Yes.
Or mixed expression.
Uh-huh.
Going to church is no longer a foundational thing to do. It goes on the list of soccer practice and ballet.
Sure, Sabbath is gone, and with it, the worship focus. Yes.
Ethnic services or involving yourself with intimacy in the relationship level in the church, like wanting intimacy but not being present.
Uh huh. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, the nerve. Okay. Yes, John.
Along the same lines, apparently the CEO of Starbucks refers to himself as the primary evangelist for Starbucks.
Yes.
And their goal is that every Starbucks customer should be an evangelist.
Yes.
We're embarrassed by the word, but they are very comfortable with it.
Yes. Spirited organization with a mission statement?
Yes.
I mean, they've been borrowing our language for years.
Well, no, we don't use that language anymore. We're embarrassed by evangelism, but Starbucks is into it. So is Apple, are evangelizing their new paper thins and creating the 10th commandment violations in myself that would be coveting, in case you're wondering. And Microsoft also sends out software evangelists. We don't do that because we don't do that kind of thing. What else? Yes. Kvetching small groups. Yes, okay. Yes.
I mean, you can go into the Hallmark store and find a huge display that'll have little Buddhas you can get for a tranquility garden, and there's all kinds of Eastern, say, spirituality right there in a very commercial context that you probably have protest groups if the local Hallmark had, you know, crucifixes and things like that. Christian store, so that I think what we're confronting is, why is it friendlier to investigate Kabbalah as opposed to come down the street to the local parish?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yes, I'm just debating how the parish would get into Hallmark, but the dollar store has the Buddhas too.
Yeah.
You obviously travel in better circles, so than I do. Yes. Anything else that you want to...
People thinking that their reasons why their kids or grandkids don't go to things, why it's not filled with everyone else, their reasons are legitimate, but other people's reasons are not legitimate.
Yeah. All right. So are we all, are we fairly much in agreement that we're perplexed? Okay. I just like to have company. For those of us who have our roots and our memories in Christendom, it is like sometimes standing on an island where the waters are rising and the dry land is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And for those of you who have been church planting, you've already been a lot farther out from high ground. And some of you are already standing underwater. But if we think of it as concentric, incidentally, many of us have had wonderful experiences going out into the water with Jesus to be fishers of men, but there have always been dry land to bring people back to and for us to go and refresh ourselves. I mean, that is how church planting and evangelism has worked pretty much in the past. And we teach people how to live abundantly on dry land. If we think of it as concentric rings beginning with Christendom on the highest point of land, and I don't mean that in a triumphalistic sense, just work the analogy with me, okay? And the pre-Christians, I've put these wonderful categories that we got last night up on the screen. If we imagine the pre-Christians, I'm going to invite George up to tell us if we've misused them, but the pre-Christians are on the upper slopes, and there's a nice grassy meadow of post-Christians and the lowland malarial marsh, which is hostile to Christians and Christianity. So the question I would like you to reflect on for a moment is, where is your ministry located right now? Up on the high point of dry land, on the slopes of pre-Christian? Is your ministry down in the grassy meadows of post-Christian unchurched? Or are you living down in the swamp? Just take a moment to reflect and then share the result of your reflection with one person near to you, if you would. Introverts, this will be the last time I do this to you. Second last, I lied. Okay, come back. Please come back. The Lord be with you. United Church. I apologize. I'm told that borders on sacrilegious to bring you back that way, but it's okay so long as we pray afterwards. So, God be with us. The second question I want you to contemplate for a moment is if you know where you are, where are the people you want to reach? I asked you where you were. If you know where you were, then it's only one question. If you don't, it may be many more than that. Where are the people you want to reach? Contemplate that for a moment, if you would. Where are the people Jesus has for you to reach? But only if that question does not dig you with a little bit of guilt, because guilt is not a fine motivator for ministry. And could you just take a very brief moment to share where you think the people are that you might reach are on that slope? Hey, Duke.
transfer growth?
I'm going to, you know, there are a lot of things that, and what are they? No, most churches lose them by transfer out. All right, then. I know some of you are working out your entire evangelistic strategy. I see fresh expressions emerging everywhere. I'm not going to embarrass or put anybody under pressure by asking where on the slope you're living and where on the slope we're reaching. But it's an interesting question, isn't it? And one of the things I realize is having been born in Christendom and having been trained in Christendom, my roots are there the same way my grandparents who immigrated to Canada with their children in the 1950s, my grandfather never learned to speak English. He'd learn 5 words, he'd forget them the next day. My father, who came as a young man in his 20s, learned to speak English, but even 60 years later, we're not sure whether he's speaking English. He's got a Dutch accent that, you know, he'd say, let's get the yellow. We'd say, the yellow, what do you mean the yellow? The orange, the blue, the yellow. He says, no, you get the yelly powder and you put it in the fridge and you get the yellow. And of course, I was born in Canada and speak hardly any Dutch. When your parents get exasperated, the Dutch you learn isn't helpful when there's somebody in the room who speaks it. But you know, for those of us who were born in Christendom, some are never going to be able to learn the language. And some, like me, who are experiencing the transition as adults, are trying really hard, but I know I have a foul accent. And people who are fluent sometimes, you know, they're being so patient and kind, and they're saying, what the heck did you jump back into? I thought you were here, and you're speaking over there. And it's a challenge that we're always learning to speak in a language that is not our native tongue. And my hope is that for the generation who have been born in whatever we are, I don't know if it's post-Christian, I don't know what the categories are or what they mean or how long they apply, but I'm hoping that there will be a generation of people who do not speak with an accent and yet are rooted clearly in the gospel of Jesus Christ. But for many of us, it means that we will spend our time checking and cross-checking ourselves and each other to see, have I gone back over the border? Do I need to think over here? Particularly when we serve people who are clearly in Christendom and there is a powerful gravitational pull dragging on us back. And I know many of you have spoken of churches where you know what you want to do, God's given you a vision, God's given you gifts, and yet there's a block that you're working with who are clearly somewhere else. And, you know, you might mutter to yourself, God has called me to love them. But it is a challenge that every generation of faces transition also has to face, and other generations have faced it, and we will face it too. At one time, I thought of evangelism as picture an ocean full of people swimming, and there are people, there's water as far as the eye can see, and some people are swimming strongly, and some are flailing around, and some, you don't know how many have already gone under. And if you picture the church as a fleet of boats that Christ has sent out into the ocean, that some of the boats are big ocean liners and some are little rubber dinghies and some are just a couple of pieces of wood that are lashed together and some are taking in people actively and some are making them walk the plank and walk overboard and some haven't taken in anybody for years and some bring on people and then they sit in deck chairs on the deck and complain that the captain isn't bringing them drinks fast enough and there's not enough ice and what kind of cruise is this anyways. And of course, ultimately, the goal of all evangelism and the goal of church planting and the goal of any kind of emerging ministry is that the people who come out of the water are trained to be crew, not passengers, so that they too are launched out to do whatever is suitable to their gifts and calling, because the job is not to fill the boats, the job's to empty the water. Right? And so when we're thinking in terms of a church-centered evangelism and ministry, we're missing the point. How many churches are enough in the community is not the question. How many people who are left in the water who cannot be picked up by what's out there is really the issue for us. And you make flip remarks when you don't make flip remarks when you're in front of people, because you always stick closely to your notes. I have an unfortunate habit. And then, you get caught on tape and you can't deny it afterwards. By the way, I trade clips around, but the wedding clip, I want you to know I paid for it, obtained it legally in every way. And I'm not in favor of throwing people out to the sharks church planting, and those who survive and make it to the end receive a crown of glory, and the others go to glory a little earlier. But I think that so long as there are people out there in the water, anything that is not illegal, immoral, or unethical is probably fair game. Provided we don't manipulate people into church planting by making them outrageous promises, getting them to sign up and then changing the agreement once they got there, which incidentally is an extremely common scenario for church planters. They're wanted so badly, they're promised the sun and the moon and the stars, and they find out that they don't necessarily have what they were offered or promised. I want to share with you, you see this on the board, how helpful it is to see a grid in terms of either a sequential grid where we go from Christendom to pre-Christian, post-Christian, anti-Christian, or you can see it as high ground and waters rising. The waters have been over the top before, historically, in the Christian church. We function quite nicely, thank you, as a minority, as a persecuted minority. We thrive, for goodness sake. I just don't get it. There's no reason for us to be afraid. But having said that, I want to share with you some odd outcroppings of dry land that are appearing around us in Canada where I did not expect them to be. And then I'm going to invite George to the front to answer all of the questions that we're raising. to interact with us on questions that are coming to mind. And these are greater Toronto area phenomena, but I know that they're happening in the greater Vancouver area as well, and they may be happening elsewhere, I don't know. They're happening in London, Ontario, where I worked as well. Okay. In every industrial park and in strip malls all through the greater Toronto area, there are storefront churches appearing. Have you seen them? I think it is the case almost everywhere. I think all of us here are particularly aware of them. About 6 years ago, I was living in a very mixed neighborhood in Brampton, and that means there were Indian people from India, mostly Gujarati and Punjabi on the street, a lot of people from the Caribbean. And I was sitting outside on my porch, and I heard what sounded like a 20-voice choir singing an old Methodist hymn in multi-part harmony, and I thought, somebody is playing a CD. And then as I sat there, it was interrupted by laughter and parts of songs and some shouts, and it was obvious there were real voices behind that, and by the sound of the voices and the accent, it sounded like they were Caribbean, but there were no cars anywhere on the street. There was no traffic. There was absolutely nothing to indicate where those people are or how they got there. That's the second phenomenon. As I walk our dog around the communities of Brampton, that has happened to me several times in several locations. I hear music where there is no angel, coming from houses that have open windows and closed doors and no cars around them. Now, consider that an isolated incident for a moment. But 5 years ago, I noticed when I was doing hospital visits or bringing communion into shut-ins and nursing homes, almost every person I visited told me about a Caribbean or Filipina nurse or nurse's aide or cleaning staff who sang hymns through their room and smiled and talked about Jesus and sometimes prayed. This would be 12 or 15 different incidents. Are any of you running into that? Consider it an isolated incident for a moment. My sister lives up at Avenue Road in Lawrence, where the population of live-in Filipina nannies almost exceeds the number of children. And my little niece, who is 4 years old, began to talk to me about Jesus last summer and how much she loved Jesus. And I didn't think she was getting that from my sister and brother-in-law. So I asked her, Lucy, how did you find so much out about Jesus? And she said, Niella, her nanny, tells me about Jesus, and she loves him, and I do too. And so my four-year-old niece has her parents going to church and forces them to pray with her every night. But consider that an isolated incident. I live about 25 kilometers from the church where I pastor, and so I drive up the 410, 401, 427. It's expressway all the way. And I began to observe who was in the other cars that time of the morning on Sunday morning. And I began to notice, especially the highway through Mississauga, many of the cars have multiple people, probably of South Asian or Caribbean or African background, who have many people in the car, and they are very dressed up. Where are they going on Sunday morning? But that may be an isolated incident. I was on a panel for a TV show and met a very genteel Jamaican woman who pastors a church around the corner from me. She's across the creek in Mississauga. I have never heard of her church. It was still meeting in rented quarters when I met her, and it was at that time just a little thing of about 3,000 people. She was not ordained, but she started teaching Sunday school class about 20 years ago, and those kids became accountants and lawyers, and they mentored another generation of at-risk kids from Caribbean homes, and so on. And it's a kind of a, I think it's a kind of word of faith church, you know, God wants you to buy property. But, you know, if you're poor and black, that may be good news. Her name's Pat Young, but maybe that's an isolated incident. And so 2 months ago, I got an email from an out-of-town friend that sounded like a half-baked internet panic. It said a secret document had been leaked from the city of Brampton, where I live, planning to restrict the size of churches in industrial and commercial areas, to restrict the size of house churches to no more than 20 people, including children, to restrict the size of churches in industrial areas to no more than 3,000 square feet, to force churches to put up a bond, I think it was $450,000, before a building permit would be issued. It sounded Stalin-esque. And my friend asked me, you live in Brampton, is this true? And I hadn't heard anything of the kind. I emailed back, it sounds like a half-baked internet scare. And then I got an email from New Zealand with the same thing, and then I got something that was passed through the local ministerial network, and I have contacts in City Hall, so I contacted them and said, I'm getting this stuff. It's just weird, it's probably an internet hoax, but is there any truth to it? And I got a very polite, very carefully worded letter that indicated, yes, indeed, all of those things are under study. Now, why would the city of Brampton be trying to restrict the number of churches using space in industrial and commercial areas, the length of time they can stay there, and the size of the property? There are so many that it's messing with their tax base. I don't see them. they're invisible from where we're. So, and they want to restrict house churches, no more than 20 people, including children. What does that tell you about the complaints that are coming from neighborhoods? So, I'm wondering, if you connect all of the dots, is there a picture emerging? What are we looking at? And here's where I'm baffled putting together the pieces. You see, the from what I'm seeing in the GTA, the Caribbean and the African and the Chinese and the Tamil and the South Asian Christians are immigrating to Canada. I don't know the answer to this. Are they Christendom or are they something else? I don't know. Can I add one more puzzling thing? I know you came here for answers. I'm just giving you more questions, but it's so nice to talk to someone who understands the questions. I mean that. I really mean that. Brampton has, I think, the second biggest South Asian population of any city in the world outside India. Great restaurants. They're mostly Sikh from the Punjab. There are a significant number of Hindus and Muslims. My kids have just graduated from high school. I can tell you many of their sons and daughters do not wish to identify with their faith and their culture. Particularly the girls find it oppressive in ways that we can't even imagine. Are they pre-Christian? Are they post-Christian? Are they off-limits because they belong to other faith groups? Is Jesus a tribal God who belongs to us Christians? Or is Jesus the second person of the Trinity with eternal significance and universal significance for all? It's a question I think we need to address. You've got your... My daughter has a lovely Hindu friend. Their house has a Punjab, I can't remember, the name's just eluded me. It will come back. They have a little room with all of their gods, and in amongst all of their gods, they have a little Jesus in there. So Jesus is one of the gang. And so we have to ask ourselves at the church, is Jesus one of the gang? Is he our tribal god? Or does he have cosmic significance, which is relatable to beyond our faith groups? I worked with a church in Richmond Hill that was possibly the most culturally insensitive experience I ever had. In the days before Easter, they insisted that they would go door to door through the neighborhood and give Christian literature and invite people to the Easter services, which is good and noble. But the neighborhood between Bathurst and Bay, north of Major Mackenzie, and those of you who don't know the neighborhood can guess from the laughter. Shall we say the days before Easter also had special significance to them? In fact, in that neighborhood, it was Passover. But by sheer, dogged, relentless determination at work, at school, through business contacts, they would haul captives back to church. And as, you know, as a polite and deferential person of a United Church background, I was often absolutely mortified. And they invited me to participate in casting a demon out of a Buddhist animist. I'm thinking, is this culturally insensitive or is it acts? You understand the discomfort of ministering in the 21st century, particularly if we were born back there and are living in a postmodern culture with values that are sometimes incongruent with our faith. I'm not sure what we're looking at. But it may be a force of the kingdom to be reckoned with. It may be, I don't know that we ever want Christendom to come back, or that it can, or that it should, or that it will, but it may be what where we appear to be in water. You know the boa constrictor song, oh, gee, it's up to my knee, it's up to my knee. Oh, heck, it's up to my neck. You know, oh, dread, that in other places there are islands emerging. Is the missionary work of hospital cleaning staff going to percolate through the population the way jazz music and rock and roll were an underground movement for the last half of the first half of the 20th century and then emerged as popular culture? I don't know, but those people are very influential. What is emerging? What is hatching out of those eggs? What is lying dormant under the surface of the kingdom, waiting for the right circumstances to emerge? Are we going to recognize it as it emerges and nurture it, or will we be the new generation of Pharisees who say, you can't do it that way? It's not procedurally right. I don't know about you. I see something very hopeful on the horizon. I see something hopeful in this room. I see something hopeful happening in Sheffield Center and the expressions of church that are emerging from God knows where. I see something hopeful in the bits that I understand, and I see something hopeful in the mystery. Maybe more hopeful in the mystery. The dollars and the prestige of Christendom are shrinking. You know, the waters are coming up. Some of you are up to your neck. But the kingdom is breaking out in new ways that have nothing to do with dollars and prestige. Is God allowed to do it that way? I see something hopeful in Deuteronomy 31, verse 6, which I consider God's word to church planters. It says, be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or tremble at them, for the Lord your God is the one who goes with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. Can I have an amen?